All right, so the last subject that I'm going to cover with in the context of the Lankavatara Sutra is the appearance in the Lankavatara Sutra of the doctrine of the Trikaya, or the three aspects of Buddhahood. And although it is the case that the Trikaya in its fully developed form does not appear in the Lankavatara Sutra, nonetheless, in the Lankavatara Sutra we have indications, we have suggestions of the Trikaya doctrine, the doctrine of the three aspects of Buddhahood. And so I'm going to briefly discuss the three aspects of Buddhahood, because, as I say, although they're not, the fully developed doctrine is not present in the Lankavatara Sutra, but the seeds or the indications of this conception are there, so we can begin to acquaint ourselves with the doctrine of the Trikaya, and then we will probably have occasion to come back to this later on in our study of the Mahayana, if not in this course, then certainly in the course which I'll be teaching in the spring on the Bodhisattva ideal in theory and practice. The doctrine of the Trikaya basically elaborates the notion that the Buddha has multiple dimensions. And of these multiple dimensions, there are three in particular that are isolated for special attention, that are selected for special attention. The three kaya, or three bodies, literally the three kaya means the three bodies of the Buddha. I generally translate in this context kaya by dimension. One could also translate it as aspect. Literally kaya, of course, does mean body, but I find it a little bit simplistic to refer to the three aspects or dimensions of Buddhahood as the three bodies of Buddhahood. But nonetheless, what we are talking about here are three dimensions, three aspects of Buddhahood. Now, we already, I think, from the beginning, even though it's nowhere clearly stated, but even in the Theravada canon, even in the Theravada text, we have already an implicit division of the being of the Buddha, of Buddhahood, into two aspects: a transcendental aspect, the Dharmakaya, which is indicated when we find statements like "He who sees the Dharma sees the Buddha." The real, the most profound dimension, or the most profound aspect of the Buddha, is the Dharmakaya, the Dharma aspect. The Dharma aspect of the Buddha, the Dharma dimension, the transcendental dimension, I've translated it that way in the lecture notes. The Dharmakaya is, of course, inexpressible and inconceivable. It's the aspect of Buddhahood, it's the aspect which all the Buddhas, no matter who they may be, Shakyamuni, Dipankara, Kakyana Muni, or whoever it may be, they all have in common the Dharmakaya, and there's no distinction among the Dharmakayas of all of the Buddhas. The other day I said that they were all identical, and I'm afraid that was misunderstood. What I meant was there's no distinction between the Dharmakaya of all the Buddhas. Since the Dharmakaya is beyond all expression and beyond all conception, so there can't possibly be any distinction, any difference in the Dharmakaya of all of the Buddhas. Now that's all that I'm going to say about the Dharmakaya, because since it's beyond expression and beyond conception, there isn't really a whole lot that you can say about the Dharmakaya, except just that, that you can't say anything about it, and you can't even imagine it, you can't even think of it. So this is the one aspect of Buddhahood that is, I think, has always been implicitly there in the Buddhist tradition, even if it hasn't been explicitly indicated. In opposition to the Dharmakaya, there's always been a conception of the form dimension of the Buddha, the Rupakaya, which means the aspect of the Buddha, the aspect of Buddhahood that appears in the world. If we didn't have a Rupakaya of the Buddha, we wouldn't have had the Buddha Shakyamuni, we wouldn't have had an historical Buddha, we wouldn't have Buddhas that appear in the world. So these two are the fundamental divisions of the nature of Buddha being, the nature of Buddhahood. On the one hand, the Dharmakaya, or the transcendental dimension, which is indescribable, inconceivable, inexpressible. And then on the other hand, we have the Rupakaya, or the form dimension of the Buddha, which takes up a form in time and space, an historical form, or it can be an archetypal form, but in any case a form, and which has a name, and which has a particular appearance, or particular, which has particular characteristics. So these are the two, let us say, the two fundamental dimensions, the two basic dimensions of Buddhahood: the Dharmakaya, the formless, inexpressible, transcendental dimension, and the dimension that has form, the dimension that has an appearance in the phenomenal world. Now, in the Mahayana, the form dimension is subdivided into what we call the celestial dimension and the terrestrial dimension, the Sambhogakaya and the Nirmanakaya. Now, the Sambhogakaya has been translated in various ways. It's been called the enjoyment body, it's been called the refulgent body, and so forth. I have chosen to translate it as the celestial dimension for reasons which I think will become clear as I explain the nature of the Sambhogakaya. The Nirmanakaya, or the sort of Nirmana means created, or actually almost or emanated, manifested dimension of the Buddha. This I've called the terrestrial dimension, because the Nirmanakaya appears to us on this earth. It appears to us here and now. It appears to us. It appeared to the men and women of the 6th century BC when Shakyamuni taught in the Magadhan country and throughout the region of northeast central India. And the Nirmanakaya is the form of the Buddha that appears here on earth to ordinary living beings. Appears or doesn't appear, of course, also because, as you remember, there were some people who encountered the Buddha who did not recognize the Buddha, who did not realize that they in fact had encountered the Buddha. But these two dimensions, the celestial dimension and the terrestrial dimension, the Sambhogakaya and the Nirmanakaya of the Buddha, are both very important for the emancipating work of the Buddha, the liberating work of the Buddha. I told you when we were talking about the message of the Lotus Sutra that according to the Lotus Sutra, the Buddha never enters extinction. He never ceases to be active and to be present and to work for the world, work for the benefit, work for the liberation of living beings. This is said, the Buddha himself, in the Buddha's own words, whether you accept the authenticity, the genuine character of the Lotus Sutra or not, The fact of the matter is that the Lotus Sutra does state, that the Buddha does state in the Lotus Sutra, the statement is made by the Buddha, according to the sutra, that since countless aeons and for countless aeons to come, I will be working for the liberation, for the benefit of living beings. I will be working in this world, I'll be working elsewhere, I'll be talking about my own career, my own activities, I'll be talking about the activities and the lives of other Buddhas, but I will be tirelessly working for the liberation of living beings. So a consideration of the Sambhogakaya, the celestial dimension, and the Nirmanakaya, the terrestrial dimension of the Buddha, is very important to appreciate the Buddha's activity in the phenomenal world. The Dharmakaya, of course, is without activity. The Dharmakaya is completely beyond this world. But the Sambhogakaya, the celestial dimension, and the Nirmanakaya, which are both aspects of the Rupakaya, the form dimension, these appear in the world, and these appear for the purpose of liberating living beings. Now, firstly, with regard to the celestial dimension, why is this not just another dimension? Why is this not available to all of us? Why do we refer to it as a celestial dimension? Because this dimension of Buddhahood, first of all, very often the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas who appear in the Sambhogakaya dimension, in the celestial dimension, dwell in the various pure lands, in the various heavens. So, for example, Maitreya, the future Buddha, in most cases, you want to see Maitreya, you have to go to the Tushita heaven. Just like that sculptor who wanted to make an image of Maitreya, he had to have someone able to go to the Tushita heaven to see Maitreya and to come back and tell him what Maitreya looked like. Because most people can't see Maitreya. Well, we can see pictures and sculptures and images of Maitreya, but we can't see Maitreya directly. Just like most of us can't see Avalokiteshvara directly. You know, we can't see. We can see images, we can see statues, but we don't see Avalokiteshvara walking down the street. We don't meet him in the mall, in the supermarket, you know, nor do we meet him even in the forest. And same thing is true of Manjushri and the other exalted bodhisattvas. They are encountered in the pure lands, in the heavens, or they are encountered by people with elevated, with highly purified faculties. That's what we were saying when we talked about seeing the Buddha preaching the Dharma on the Vulture Peak in the Lotus Sutra, that is possible if we purify our faculties. Now, there's a story which I probably will tell you in January, but I can tell you it now in any case, because it illustrates this point very well. The story about Asanga, who was the founder of the Yogacara school, which we are, in fact, looking now at the antecedents of the Yogacara school, or the canonical bases of the Yogacara school. The story about Asanga, who wanted to realize Maitreya, and I'll just tell the story very briefly here, and I'll tell it to you in more detail in January, probably, if I remember to tell it to you. But it's a story about Asanga wanting to see Maitreya. Eventually he does see Maitreya. In fact, the texts of Asanga, the five major texts of Asanga, are believed by Buddhist, Mahayana Buddhists, to have been dictated to Asanga by Maitreya. Anyway, Asanga goes and into retreat, he goes into a cave to meditate on Maitreya. And he meditates for 3 years and he has no experience, he doesn't see Maitreya. And he comes out of the cave and he's about to give up and go back to the monastery and so on. And on the way down from the cave, he sees a man rubbing a piece of iron with a feather. And he says, "What are you doing? Why are you rubbing this piece of iron with a feather?" And the man says, "Oh, I'm making a needle. And Asanga says, well, my God, if worldly people can be so patient as to make needles by rubbing iron with a feather, then maybe I gave up my meditation too quickly. And so he goes back to the cave and he meditates for another 3 or 6 or 9 years now, I don't recall how many. The story is that at the end, Maitreya comes out of the cave without still not having had a vision of Maitreya. But on his way back down to the village, back down to the monastery, he comes across a very ill dog, a dog that is lying on the roadside, sick, with worms infesting its wounds and so forth. And Maitreya has great pity for the dog and he wants to relieve the suffering of the dog. Asanga. Asanga has great pity for the dog and he wants to, thank you, he wants to relieve the suffering of the dog, but he doesn't want to injure the worms, so he decides that the only way he can remove the worms from the wounds of the dog without injuring the worms is to remove them with his tongue. So he bends down to remove the worms with his tongue, and then suddenly the dog disappears into a rainbow, into a burst of rainbow colored light, and Maitreya appears to Asanga. And Asanga says to Maitreya, well, you know, I'm very glad to see you, but where have you been for the last 12 years when I've been meditating on you all the time? And Maitreya says, I've been with you all the time. I've been here all the time. It's just that you weren't able to see me. And he says, I'll show you. So put me on your shoulders and carry me through the village. And so Asanga puts Maitreya on his shoulders and he walks through the village. And nobody sees anything. Nobody notices anything. Except for one old lady who says, why are you carrying that sick dog on your shoulders? You know, so the point of the story is that we see what we see according to the purity of our minds. When Asanga's compassion had developed to such a level that he could think about not injuring the worms and he wasn't averse to removing the worms from the wounds of the dog with his tongue just to spare the worms any injury, when his compassion had developed to that extent, he was able to see Maitreya. But no one else was able to see Maitreya, except for the old woman who saw the sick dog, you know, which meant very likely that she was, you know, on the road when she was, her faculties were more highly developed. So the point is that to see the Sambhogakaya dimension of the Buddha, we have to have purified faculties. We have to be able to travel to the heavens and so forth. This is one of the fruits that comes, for example, with the attainment of the first stage along the Bodhisattva path, the first bhumi. When you attain the first bhumi, then you can travel to the heavens and you can meet the Sambhogakaya dimension, the celestial dimension of the Buddhas, and receive teachings from them. And then, of course, in the future, after that episode, Asanga visited the heavens and he saw Maitreya regularly and received these teachings from Maitreya. So this is the celestial dimension of Buddhahood, the dimension that doesn't appear to everyone. The terrestrial dimension, on the other hand, appears to everyone. The terrestrial dimension can appear, potentially, I mean, it can appear to everyone, although not everyone will recognize it, because when we talk about the Nirmanakaya of the Buddha, the terrestrial dimension of the Buddha, we think first of the Buddha Shakyamuni. And that is correct. It's right that we should think first of the Buddha Shakyamuni, because the Buddha Shakyamuni was the most extraordinary example of the Nirmanakaya of the Buddha. He was the special instance or the special case of the Nirmanakaya of the Buddha Shakyamuni. But the Nirmanakaya of the Buddha manifests itself in many ways which we most of the time don't even recognize. We don't even appreciate that these are the terrestrial manifestations of the Buddha, the Nirmanakaya manifestations of the Buddha. So in the Lankavatara Sutra, for example, it does talk about how, out of great compassion, because of the working of skill and means, adopting the working of skill and means, the Buddha will appear in many different forms in order to help and to emancipate living beings. And at this point, we find the lengths to which the compassion and the skill and means of the Buddha will go in order to liberate living beings, in order to help living beings understand the truth. And it includes not only appearing in the form of a friend of virtue, or in the form of a master of the Dharma, of a teacher, of a monk, or the like, but it can include even appearing in the form of a drunkard or a gambler. And why is that so? Because there may be a drunkard or there may be a gambler who isn't going to listen to a discourse delivered by a monk, or isn't going to listen to anything said by a virtuous man, by a householder, but he will listen to something said by a fellow drunk. He will listen to something said by a fellow gambler. So in order to emancipate even the worst among living beings, even the most dissolute, the most defiled among living beings, the Buddha will take the form of one of that company for the specific purpose of emancipating that person. And the Buddha will also take the form, the terrestrial form, the Nirmanakaya form, of inanimate things, a bridge, food, medicine. There's a verse in Shantideva's Bodhicaryavatara, a text that we will study in the springtime when we look at the theory and practice of the Bodhisattva ideal. There's a verse in his career of the Bodhisattva, his text called the Bodhicaryavatara, where he prays. He said, may I become hungry, may I become food for the hungry, may I become medicine for the sick, may I become shelter for the homeless. And this is part and parcel of the altruism, of the compassion, of the skill and means of the Buddha, who through these countless manifold manifestations helps countless living beings in indescribable and unimaginable ways, unrecognized ways, ways that these living beings are not even aware of. So one practical lesson to learn from this teaching, if you are ready to learn it, is that we should always treat all living beings with the greatest respect, no matter how ignorant they may appear to be, no matter how rude or crude they may appear to be. Treat them with the utmost respect, because you never know, they may be a manifestation of the Buddha, they may be a bodhisattva. Treat all living beings as if they were bodhisattvas, even if they appear not to be, even if they appear to be crude, even if they appear to be ignorant, even if they appear to be evil. Treat all living beings with respect, because none of us, we ourselves would have to be liberated, emancipated, enlightened people to be able to recognize all the manifestations of the Buddha. And since we can't be sure, it's better to be safe and treat everybody with respect, because they may be bodhisattvas, they may be manifestations of the Buddha. So this is the last advice, or the last, it's hardly the last lesson to be learned from the Lankavatara Sutra. Lankavatara Sutra, as I said in the beginning, is an immense and complex text. But this is certainly one of the aspects of the sutra which has practical implications for how we relate to our fellow human beings. And it is also an indication of the Mahayana view of the Buddha, who is in a sense all pervasive. He is transcendental, but he is also eminent. He's here in everything. And in that sense, we all live, know it or not, we all live in a Buddha land. Actually, here at IBC, I have to say, I think this is the most peaceful and quiet place that I have visited in a long time. Every place I go, even places that are supposed to be peaceful and quiet, are no longer peaceful and quiet. I spent a few days, a week, a couple of years ago at the International Forest Monastery in Ubon, and it's also a very, very peaceful place. It's also a very spiritual place. But unfortunately, between the airport, that's not so far away, and the fact that there was some, they were clearing some timber, so the chainsaws and the, you know, the motorcycles on the road and so forth, you know, it was not quiet. Here it is perfectly quiet. It's peaceful. It really is peaceful. You just are surrounded by the forest, you know, which is something really precious in this 21st century. Very, very hard to find. So in that respect, I have to say that, you know, without exaggeration, you can create here a kind of pure land, yes, a kind of Buddha land, you know, where one can really dedicate oneself to study and meditation and worship. And that's a wonderful thing. That's really a very, very precious thing. So I have now a few minutes left here. I have also some excerpts from the Lankavatara Sutra, which perhaps we can read, but we perhaps can read them later. Would you like, have you got questions that you want to ask at this point? Should I keep some highlights from the sutra for the meeting, the class this afternoon, or should I begin with those, and what would you like to do? Have you got questions that you want to ask at this point, or? Well, make up your minds quickly, don't waste time.
In Chan school, there is one, we call the dry wood tradition avoid. So that means the person, they take meditation in their mind, they like the dry wood. So at that time, their mind is also pure, because their mind is not wandering. So if that is pure, but why we should avoid, and so how to exactly interpret purity?
Well, we can interpret purity on many levels, obviously, and one level is a dualistic level, which is to say that you know, the mind is pure or free from certain unwholesome thoughts and so on and so forth. But the purity which we speak of when we talk about the original mind, or the primordial mind, the fundamental mind, the mind of the Lankavatara Sutra, that purity is a purity which is beyond all extremes. And in that sense, it's pure even of the extremes of purity and impurity. Because we're talking again there about a transcendental mind, you know. Now, I don't know, you know, exactly what the meaning is of the state that you refer to in Chan meditation. I'm not that conversant with the Chan tradition, but I would say that when you find statements about purity of the original mind or the fundamental mind and so forth. We're talking there about a purity which is equivalent to emptiness. The real point here is that, as I said yesterday, emptiness is neither existent nor non-existent. The ultimate reality is a combination of emptiness and luminosity. Why is it a combination of emptiness and luminosity, or emptiness and brightness? Because it's not any one thing, it's not any fixed thing, it doesn't have any fixed nature, but also it is not nothing. It's not just a blank. And that aspect of it, that dimension of its being, its reality, which is not nothing, is luminous, it's bright. And that's what we refer to when we say purity. So the ultimate reality is empty slash pure, or empty slash luminous. It's nothing in itself, but it's not any individual thing. It doesn't involve the existence of individual entities or objects or persons. But then again, it's not nothing. It does have a bright and luminous quality. And actually, this is part of what I wanted to talk about. So since it has sort of come up in this context, let me just refer to it. I talked about how by purifying the stored consciousness you could achieve Buddhahood, and how the stored consciousness in that sense was the Buddha nature, or the Tathagata Garbha, in the sense that by purifying the storehouse consciousness you could achieve Buddhahood. But I didn't talk about how then that would work. Well, as a matter of fact, in the beginning of the Lankavatara Sutra, which we are going to look at in more detail this afternoon, I suppose, to the degree that we have time, but in the beginning of the Lankavatara Sutra, it again uses the analogy of the ocean, the wind, and the waves. Now, in the body of the text, in most cases, the analogy of the ocean, the wind, and the waves is an analogy which describes how we get entangled in samsara. We have this initially pure, tranquil, original mind, which is disturbed by the wind of discrimination, by the wind of the afflicted mind, and then we have the waves of the ordinary sense consciousness and karma and so forth. But actually, once the original mind, once the alive vijnana is purified, and we have the emergence of the Buddha, of the Bodhisattva, on the basis of that original mind, then we can also have a different application, we can have a different interpretation of the simile of the ocean, the wind, and the waves. And this we have in the beginning of the Lankavatara Sutra. If you look at your excerpt, and hopefully we'll have time to read some of the Lankavatara in the evening, but if you look at your excerpt, you see that in this case, what does it say? It says, the tranquil mind of the Buddha, which was like the ocean, you know, perceived the agitation in the minds of the audience, and it was stirred by the wind of compassion. So, you see, you can turn this analogy around. On the one hand, the analogy is a metaphor. It describes what happens when we get entangled in samsara because of discrimination and the purity of the mind, the calm depths of the store consciousness is disturbed, and then we have the appearance of the six ordinary senses and the various afflictions and karma and so forth. But on the other hand, we can look at it another way. We still have the alaya there. The alaya doesn't go away. The alaya still got all these seeds, all these sense experiences. Only thing, now we don't have the wind of discrimination, which is subject-object duality, which is the ego principle. But here we can have the wind of compassion. Like I said yesterday, I think I talked about the analogy of the wind chime, how the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are like wind chimes, and they respond to the wind of the karmic necessity of living beings, and they teach the appropriate dharma according to that wind automatically without having to think about it. Well, here also we have the Buddha whose mind is like the tranquil ocean, but it responds to the wind of the requirements of the disciples, of the audience who want to know the answer to various questions. So the Buddha, out of compassion, now the wind is not the wind of ego discrimination, of self, subject, object duality. Now the wind is the wind of compassion. It's the wind. The Buddha responds to the needs of the living beings by preaching the Dharma. And when he does that, the storehouse consciousness becomes like a repository of costumes. Becomes like a repository. I can put it this way, you know, if, suppose we as ordinary living beings, we are assigned roles. Our karma is the director of the play that we find ourselves in. And according to our karma, we're assigned roles. Some of us are carpet cleaners, some of us are jet pilots, some of us are business executives, some of us are Buddhist scholars, some of us are monks, nuns, whatever. We take up these roles according to our karma. Now, when we are liberated, when we become Buddhas or advanced Bodhisattvas, we don't have to take up any, we can select the role that we think is most suitable for our, for teaching living beings. And then we can go, we can have recourse to the Alaya Vijnana, which has got all, which is really, in that case, it's really like a storehouse with all kinds of costumes, all kinds of props, everything that you could possibly need to put up a play to liberate living beings. So the enlightened ones, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, they can have recourse to the Alaya Vijnana in order to collect together, in order to take what they need in order to emancipate living beings. I'm sorry, I have not, I mean, I did not directly answer your question. The point that I wanted to make was that the activity of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas is then free, it's altruistic, it's in order to liberate living beings, but it makes use of all of the things of the world, all of the things that we are familiar with. So the Buddha will appear to us, as I was saying a moment ago, as a gambler, as a drunkard, as a monk, as a friend of virtue, etc. He will appear in many, many different roles in order to benefit living beings. And the reason that he can do that is because he has access to the Alaya Vijnana. He has access to this whole store of human experience, this whole store of images, of forms, of objects, of roles. And he has free access to that, in the sense that he's not like us, that we come into this world and karma tells us, this is your costume, this is your role, this is what you're going to, the part that you're going to play in this drama. The Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are not like that. They can choose the part that they think is the most beneficial one to play in order to liberate living beings. I think I put off anybody who wanted to ask a question. Never mind. This evening we will look a little bit at the Lankavatara, and then we'll leave some time for questions. Okay, thank you.